This is Jesse Goldberg-Strassler, and it's time for Ballpark Digest's Broadcaster Chat. I'm joined by Mick Gillespie. I'm the voice of the Lansing Lugnuts, and Mick is the voice of the Tennessee Smokies. Mick, how are you?
I'm good, Jesse. A little different not actually seeing your face this week, but it's good to hear your voice, and I hope all is well.
You can imagine how I look. Let's talk about things. Let's start off with this. This is one of the fun things that we were talking about in going through week by week. What ballparks have you been to recently?
Well, we went to Birmingham, and then we went to Jacksonville. We just got back from Jacksonville. The baseball grounds of Jacksonville, it's nestled right in downtown near the St. John's River. It's in the parking lot with the famous Gator Bowl, which I don't know what the Jaguars have named it this time. I think it was TIAA Stadium or something. It's had like five different sponsors. But to me, it's always been the Gator Bowl. And so we were actually there during the NFL draft. So we was going to try to get the team a tour of the stadium, but because they were so busy with all the draft stuff, we didn't get that opportunity. But it was fun, though, watching like the Jaguars make their picks. We're actually playing baseball at the time. And then since I covered the SEC, you know, they took Josh Allen with their first pick, who's just a tremendous player out of Kentucky. I had a little insight on that, too, while we were broadcasting.
What do you remember in the past? Because I think that's such a fun convergence of the NFL draft and minor league baseball. Was there an NFL draft or maybe even a baseball draft that you really remember from your past seasons?
Yeah, it's funny that you bring that up. My first year in Salem, I was the voice of the then Salem Avalanche in the Carolina League. It was my first full season broadcasting job. And we went to Lynchburg and we played the Hillcats during the draft. And the broadcaster at the time was a really good guy. His name is Matt Providence. And so he was the voice for a long time of the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs. But he's a great guy. I show up for the draft, for the game, the baseball game, and the draft's going on. And he's a Giants fan, and he's got his Giants jersey on. I remember, like, he was at the ballpark wearing his Giants jersey, and he was amped up about the NFL draft that day. You know, so that was my first memory of the intersection between our jobs as baseball broadcasters and the convenient, not so convenient NFL draft.
It's funny because the draft with regards to football and baseball, there are all the baseball players who are fans and who are deeply invested in who their team takes. But how many of these guys went to big time college programs where they were at the same school as the players? Or let me go even farther back. So I'm a big fan of Washington in the NFL. We take Montez Sweat, 26th overall, the defensive end from Mississippi State, the rush linebacker. And on the team bus with me is DJ Neal from Lithonia, or Stone Mountain, Georgia. And DJ says, "Hey, anybody see that my friend Montez was taken?" And they go all the way back to high school together. All these guys know each other, that there are those kind of coincidences.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, great athletes always respect, or for the most part, respect each other for that. And this year's draft was really different. I got a couple of intersection stories. I guess the first one is one that we all know, and that's that Kyler Murray was drafted first round by the Oakland A's last year, and then number one overall by the Arizona Cardinals this year. It's the first time that it's ever happened. When the A's drafted him out of Oklahoma, they thought, and no one anticipated that he would be the Heisman Trophy winner. Tua Tagovailoa of Alabama, if he doesn't get hurt, probably would have won the Heisman and got injured in the SEC championship game. And that was the difference. And Kyler Murray kept getting better as the season progressed. And so Murray's going to play NFL football, not baseball. And I would say over the years, baseball has probably won more of those battles with guys who could have done both. The Smokies over the years had players that were great football and baseball players. Jeff Samardzija, who's a starter for the San Francisco Giants, he was a great receiver at Notre Dame, not only a hard-throwing pitcher there. Cubs drafted him, and they paid him a lot of money. That was before the draft was slotted. not to go into the NFL. And I heard that he might have been as high as a second-round pick as a receiver. And then Matt Caesar, who I saw play football. I saw his national championship game when he was at Villanova, and he racked up over 300 total yards, you know, just of running and quarterbacking and receiving and punt returning and kick returning. He was an amazing football player, and the Cubs drafted him. And they actually redid his contract when it looked like he might be a second or third round pick in the NFL. And I think he would have been a good NFL player. But now that the draft is slotted, even the A's showed up from reports at Kyler Murray's house and tried to convince him with money to not go into the NFL. It was too late. I mean, he was the number one overall pick, and as a quarterback, you know, he's going to play. You know, and that's one thing. And then the other athlete part of this, as far as my career goes, there's a guy named Gary Hughes, who's one of the greatest scouts of all time. Baseball America, you know, years ago, they ranked the top 10 scouts of the century. And Gary was one of them. I mean, you're talking about the Branch Rickeys of the world and Buck O'Neill and these guys that who went out and found great players and, you know, made a huge impact on the sport. Well, I know Gary. Gary was with the Cubs. He's a great friend. He's an awesome person. His son Sam is one of our national cross-checkers with the Cubs. He's an excellent scout in his own right. Sam played football at La Tech. Willie Rope was his guard back then in 92. Almost beat Alabama, won the national championship that year. But Gary made an impact as a scout by realizing early that if you take great athletes that play different sports, that those guys can adapt to the game of baseball. They'll learn it. Maybe they didn't play a lot of baseball because they were playing basketball or they were playing football or they were playing something else. He also drafted or was part of drafting John Elway, you know, so he he realized that, hey, this guy's a pretty good athlete. And then, of course, John, one of the great quarterbacks of all time, didn't sign, or was actually did sign, but then, you know, left the Yankees because he didn't want to be a Baltimore Colt, which is something that I guess I should be a little bitter about, being from Baltimore. But it worked out for him. And the Colts
Mick,
left Baltimore.
Mick, you beat me to the punch. I've got John Elway's Oneonta Yankees stats here in front of me, and I was going to try to quiz you. It was on 1981 Team USA Baseball, and in 1982, playing for Oneonta in 42 games, he batted .318 with a .432 on-base percentage, slugged .464, and he stole 13 bases while putting forth 12 extra base hits, too. He was really good for that one season.
Yeah, and Gary thinks he would have been a major leaguer. I mean, if you ask him, you know, he really does. And that's because John Elway was just a great athlete, you know, and he had a great season with the Yankees and went on to the NFL and, you know, got to go back in the draft. But there are a lot of super athletes. And I guess the biggest and best one of all time, at least in my life, was Bo Jackson. And I was a kid. I didn't get to go to a lot of Oriole games. We were definitely – means-wise, not the type of family that could just go to a game. But we did go some, and there was a guy who was a big mentor in my life. His name's Father Holloway. I mean, Father Carl. Father Holloway married me. Father Carl. He took me to games every once in a while, and then we would practice broadcasting, Father Carl and I, on the ride in, not thinking that I would ever be a broadcaster, but he just thought it was something that he would like to have done if he wasn't a priest, you know? And so he would start it up. I was his color guy on the rides, you know, 6 and 7 years old. And so Bo Jackson was playing against the Orioles, and he tried to call time at the game we were at, and the pitch was thrown, and he hit a home run. I mean, it wasn't I at the time we all talked about it being one-handed. He did get his second hand back on the bat, but he had his hand back, and Father Carl looked at me and he said, just remember this because you'll never see anything like that again. And in the same game, Bo also caught a ball in the gap and ran up the side of the wall, which is something that he did on occasion. But Bo, not only was he a great Kansas City Royal and baseball player, he was an excellent running back. He was awesome. I mean, like, and if he hadn't have gotten hurt in the NFL playing for the Raiders, there's no telling. I mean, he could have been the first ever dual Hall of Famer. I mean, that's how good he was at football and baseball before his hip injury.
There is one dual Hall of Famer, but it's a bit of a cheat in that it's Cal Hubbard, who is a Major League Baseball umpire. That's how he got into the National Baseball Hall of Fame.
Yeah, yeah, I don't count. I knew about him, but I don't count umpiring. I mean, I have a lot of respect for that, but you know, like to actually have a guy who could play both, and Deion Sanders did it. I saw Deion play in New York as a kid at Yankee Stadium. He was with the Yankees at the time, and he was a very, very skinny kid that couldn't hit. And I never thought that he would turn out to be a very good baseball player, but he was on the Braves later on in his career. And I thought he wasn't one of the best players, but he was a good player. I mean, he was a good teammate and had an impact, got on base and, you know, could run balls down and stuff. And then the other guy is Brian Jordan, and he did it too. So we haven't had that in a while. I'm not sure if Kyler Murray will even have the opportunity. I can't imagine it. I don't think you could do it with a quarterback, because Deion was literally helicoptering from, you know, from one sport to the other, you know, to be at both practices. I think he was on the Falcons and the Braves at the same time. I just remember vaguely, without Googling here, him in a helicopter getting from one place to the next. And I don't know that your quarterback isn't going to be able to just helicopter out. I mean, there's a lot more to quarterbacking than just, you know, going out there and practicing. I mean, you have to do all the film study and work with the other guys on your team.
I think if you said simply, and not just Deion, not just Bo, I'm glad you brought in Brian Jordan too, there were more than one person, there was more than two people who were doing the football-baseball thing throughout the late 80s, early 90s, and it was a ton of fun. And you could watch them play both sports. This was something that was being done decades ago. You could go back into the 1950s, 1960s, and there were guys playing in both the NBA and Major League Baseball.
Yeah, and I didn't know that. I mean, you know, like that, but it doesn't surprise me. I mean, the guy who, when I think of like the best dual sport athlete of my time, didn't do that, but he could have. Dave Winfield could have played in the NBA,
yes.
could have played baseball. And I think like if you can do both of those, I mean, the NBA, to play in the National Basketball Association, you have to be just an absolutely sick athlete. You know, like I've heard baseball players tell me before, you know, I'm not an athlete, I'm a baseball player. I think that's changed somewhat, you know, over the years. But to play in the NBA, I mean, like to run up and down the court and do that, I mean, that shows that, you know, that you're phenomenal. But then the opportunity to be able to, you know, pick between sports. And I wonder now, the way that baseball set up financially, if Dave Winfield would have picked the NBA over Major League Baseball. You know, back then, and you know, when he was coming out in the 70s, the NBA, you know, wasn't really that popular of a sport. You know, according to Forbes, the NBA and baseball are kind of on the same plane right now as far as the values go, and maybe even the interest, which is surprising to me. But I mean, that's a totally different show. But you know, at the same time, I mean, just athletically speaking, to be able to do both of those things really shows you how great Dave Winfield was. And look, he's a baseball Hall of Famer. So, I mean, like, that's enough said.
I got one for you. This might surprise you. It was a guy who was drafted in the second round in 1996. He was drafted out of Washington State in the NBA by the Philadelphia 76ers. He was also drafted to play Major League Baseball. And he played Major League Baseball afterward. He played baseball from 2002 through 2011. He was drafted by the Braves in the 13th round in 92. Later on, he was taken again, a final drafting in 1997 by the Toronto Blue Jays in the 20th round. And he played both. Mark Hendrickson. Hendrickson played
Wow.
the NBA for the Sixers, the Sacramento Kings, the New Jersey Nets, the Cleveland Cavaliers from 96 through 2000. And then you fast forward a couple of years later, and there he is, as a 6'9 left-hander pitching in 10 seasons in the major leagues.
Yeah, that's amazing too. I forgot about him. That really goes to show, you know, like we're certain people are just gifted, you know, I mean, they're just gifted with amazing athletic ability. The thing about baseball that makes it tough is that there's so much strategy involved. It's a thinking man's game. And I think that's why I like it so much. And you really have to play a lot to kind of get the, you know, kind of get that, go through the mistakes that it takes to learn from them, right? And but you know what? If you go out there and pitch, you know, and you throw hard and you can throw strikes, I mean, you know, look, there's guys that pitched and then they go and they coach high school and then all of a sudden they heal up and then they're back in the big leagues again. I mean, that's happened before, you know. So
let me tell you the story of Anthony Alford. Anthony Alford was Mr. Football and Mr. Baseball in the state of Mississippi as a quarterback. And so he goes and often he plays in the SEC, but at the same time, the Blue Jays draft him. I think he was a fourth-round draft choice. And so Alford plays a week, not too long in the minor leagues, goes off and plays college football, transfers, comes back. I first meet him in 2014. They send him to us for, I'm not kidding you, 5 days. He comes and plays 5 games with the Lugnuts, is utterly electric as a 19-year-old, and then he waves goodbye to everybody, and he goes back to playing football, and now he's switched to safety, and he's transferred to a different school. But in the end, what Anthony said was two different things. He said, first, the headaches got to him in football. That's why he said, I'm going to go to baseball full-time. And the other thing he said was, in football, he couldn't really process the atmosphere. It was all going by in a hurry, and he was so into the game, and the adrenaline was flowing. And he joined us for the 4th of July in 2014, when we have nearly 13,000 fans. And he was simply able, because you're able as a baseball player in the dugout, to look around and take in the atmosphere. And he said, you know what? This is all right. And now we've seen him make his major league debut. He's been up with the Blue Jays, and now he's in AAA. He committed to baseball full-time after going back and forth between the SEC and the minor leagues.
Yeah, well, how about this? I mean, you talk about the two biggest examples in the last, 20 years of guys trying to do both. Michael Jordan, who's the greatest NBA player of all time. I don't think there's any argument on this, right? I mean, you agree, right? Jordan's the greatest.
I agree
with
you.
And then remember.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I see. I got a thumbs up from Spencer. He's in here right now. Yeah, Jordan's the best ever. And then he tried to play baseball, you know, although the numbers weren't great, by the end of the, you know, the season that he had in the Southern League with the Barons, he was competitive. Like, and who knows what would have happened. And then Tim Tebow, Heisman Trophy winner, won a playoff game in the NFL as a quarterback. And he's on the verge right now. I mean, he's in AAA of possibly breaking through and making it to the big leagues with the Mets.
It's fun. It's really fun. Those dual sport, or maybe even for certain guys more than that. Let me give you a guy, I never played professional basketball, but you and I being Marylanders, I don't know if you heard anything about the Cal Ripken Jr. basketball games, but I heard they were legendary and highly competitive.
Yep. I've heard that too. Yeah, that he'd invite people over. He had that court built in his house. When I used to drive to my grandparents' house, I drove by Cal Ripken's place, his old place. I know he sold it, but, I would go, they lived in Butler, Maryland. And then, you know, I would come through there, you know, going up north to the north part of the state. And I forget the road. I want to say it was Schwann Road. If anyone out there is listening, you know what I'm talking about. You go down this, this long street and you turn, and right where the turn was by all the horse farms, there was this giant mansion and it was Cal Ripken's. And then you would hear these stories about what was going on at Cal's house. You know, not only this incredible batting cage that he had, but also that he had a full length basketball court and that, they a bunch of games there. You couldn't see the court though, from the drive, and there were gates there. So it's not like you could have just drove up to Cal's house to see if you could jump in on a pickup game.
Let me twist things about, because we all got started talking about this subject because you were in Jacksonville during the NFL draft. Jacksonville is notable because the stadiums are all right next door to one another. They border each other. You also have the Hall of Fame for Florida and Georgia, with the world's largest outdoor, the cocktail party that it used to be called. Now they've changed the name. But here's my question for you. Do you prefer the downtown stadium, or would you prefer a stadium to be away from downtown?
Oh, I'm 100% for a downtown stadium. I love them. You know, like, I love them. And I know the Smokies don't have one. And I'm actually, like, you know, kind of off the beaten path here. And I love it here, too. But, you know, if it was, you know, when you go to games at Camden Yards and you get to the Inner Harbor and the Ravens stadium's right next door, and then there's, you know, Camden Yards. I mean, it's just great. You know, all the restaurants that are around it, the atmosphere, you know, when it's like 7 o'clock and the sun's out, and then, you know, 8:30, you know, the sun's going down and you have like the reflection of the sun, you know, coming off of the buildings and the glow that the city has with the lights. There's just something that feels big about that to me. And when we play Birmingham and we're there, and it's the same thing, you know, like just that ambiance. And then the other thing is I like the fact that, you know, Camden Yards really helped revitalize Maryland and Baltimore. And it was a city that at the time really needed something, you know, it really needed new life, you know. And when that stadium was built, you know, this, you know, it brought people and excitement back to the downtown area, you know, that wasn't a real great part of town at the time, you know. And it's the same thing in Birmingham. When I'm there, they just built the stadium like 5 years ago, and now there's, you know, there's some breweries there and some restaurants and some condos and some hotels, and it just feels like a very cool place to be, you know. And so I appreciate that part of it. How about
I'm
you?
The same as you, but I agree, but I'm going to throw in some different ideas. The stadiums that I grew up remembering going to, like the Bowie Bay Sox, for example, I grew up being used to a stadium surrounded by parking lots. You would go, and the stadium it had been given its huge area, and there was a sea of parking lots around it, and there's still a number of ballparks like that in the Midwest League where it's just this area has been dedicated to the ballpark, and there's plenty of space for everybody to park. And then let me give you the converse to that is I think about Wrigley Field, or I think about Old Memorial Stadium, where they were tucked into a suburban neighborhood. Wrigley Field is amongst everybody who lives there. So you've got all the trees and you've got everybody living in the residential neighborhood. And then, hey, look, there's the ballpark. That's what I remember about going to Memorial Stadium was you drove past house after house. You made a left here. You made a right there. And suddenly, boom, in the middle of this residential neighborhood, hey, look, it's a baseball stadium.
Yeah, well, you bring those two up, and they're my two favorite too. That's the ironic part about it. But I don't. When I think of Wrigley, I remember as a kid watching the Cubs on WGN, never thinking that I would go to a game there. Just loved Harry and Steve, you know, and the Cubs, and I always thought it looked like a movie set, you know, like the people on the rooftops and the, you know, just the coziness of it. When you ask me that, I'm not thinking like Wrigley. I'm thinking Wrigley is still downtown. I mean, it's, you know, even though it's not, I mean, in my mind it was. And when I went there for the first time, it felt the same way. I mean, I just got that excitement, the same excitement that I had as a kid going to Memorial Stadium, you know. And when I went to Memorial Stadium, you're right. I mean, my dad, we didn't have much money. And when you get older, you realize like, what $20 means. You know, I can remember him saying, hey, I got $20. If you think we can go for $20 to, you know, see the Orioles play, then, you know, we'll do it. But we're going to have to buy the $1 giant food seats, sit in the bleachers. And then we parked for free. We parked, there's a 7-Eleven when you come off of 83, I think. And I don't know, even know if it's still there, but we used to park behind that 7-Eleven and then walk like a mile and a half, you know, maybe even further through that neighborhood.
The long walk to the ballpark. And then after the game ended, the long walk back.
Yeah. And people would be on the porches, and then you knew you were getting close because there'd be hawkers outside, you know, cheaper on the outside, you know, you get like my concessions normally happened about, you know, a half a mile from actually getting there, but there was never a better feeling to me than when you'd get that ticket and you would go through and they would take it, you go through the turnstile, and then the ramps at Memorial Stadium, we went really high in the ramp, you know, and you would go up those, they were like, you know, just giant like cylinders, you know, and you would go keep going up and up and up. But there was a spot, and I would run ahead and I could see through the ramp. And I could see, like, there was a gate there, there were some seats, and I could see the field. And when Cal Ripken retired, it was almost I almost cried because I just remembered my whole life I would run up there, and we always seemed to time it when the Orioles were taking BP or they were doing like some kind of fielding, because I would see Cal at short throwing balls to Eddie at first base, you know, and I can see it so clear in my mind, like through that little like just that little gap, you know, when I would look over that concrete and just kind of peer through there, you know. But yeah, I mean, look, a major league stadium is great, whether it's downtown or whether it's, you know, somewhere in the suburb. But yeah, both. But you struck a chord there when you talk about Wrigley, and you know, and then of course Memorial Stadium, which doesn't exist anymore.
The idea that you brought up, and I completely agree with you about this, that a ballpark being placed in an area, in a neighborhood, and then the neighborhood getting built up around the ballpark, because that's where people are now coming. That happened in Lansing, Michigan. This is the legend that is told to everybody who comes into the area like me. Hey, before the ballpark was built on this site, on Michigan Avenue between Cedar Street and Larch Street, this was not an area where you would want to be. This was certainly not an area where you would want to bring your family. And after that, after the stadium was built and opened up in 1996, now it's the stadium district. Now we've got the apartments beyond the center field wall. There are apartments that are out to the left side, out beyond Cedar Street. Behind us, directly in front of the ballpark where everybody enters in, Caddy Corner, there's a grocery store that's going to be opening up and more. So the revitalization is continuing for this downtown area, and it's all because this site was chosen for the stadium in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, my dad gave me some great advice too. Talking about like what it means, what your team means to your city. When I was a kid, he was a Redskins fan, a huge Redskins fan. He worked in like Rockville, Maryland, some, you know, he'd have to go up to the DC area, and he just, and everyone liked the Redskins and he liked the Redskins. And then later, you know, before he passed away, he did a lot of his, you know, doctors and stuff were in New York, upper state New York. And while he was up there, you know what? The Buffalo Bills were good. And I remember, like, you know, coming to visit him, and all of a sudden, you know, the Redskins stuff was gone, and there was, you know, Bills hats. And I said, well, Dad, I thought you were a Redskins fan. Well, I like the Redskins, but you know what? I live up here now, and, you know, like, when in Rome, you know? And it's, I mean, like, that part, that's cool too. You know, like, I get that. Like, when you are in a certain place, you know, it's like you definitely want to support the team that's there, you know, because it's just part of the community. You know, it's like the community aspect of, like, they're wearing your colors, they've got your name on the front there. And I think that's why we hold our athletes to such high esteem too, is because they, whether it's fair or not, that they are role models. You know, I know Charles Barkley might not agree with me, but they are, you know, because kids look up to them, and because we look up to them, you know, and it's a hard, high standard to have, but, you know, but for what they mean to the community, and what they represent, you know, I mean, that's what a lot of people that are young want to aspire to be.
You can change somebody's day by hitting a home run. You can put a smile on somebody's face if they're a fan of your team and you win the game. I don't know about you, that makes my day. If I'm a fan of a team and my team wins, that's everything for me. And if it's a football team that wins, I'm going to be on cloud nine for the next week until they play their very next game. That feeling for me as a fan of saying, I've chosen this team, I love this team, this is my favorite player. And then you remember this feeling, Nick, going to the ballpark and suddenly there's not just you wearing your favorite team's gear. Everybody's wearing the colors. Everybody's wearing the caps. Everybody's wearing the shirts. And you feel like, oh my God, I'm in the right spot to be right now. I am in heaven.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. When I became a Cubs fan, you know, I was in middle school and I'd watch them on TV. And then I had to mow grass to like earn the money to get my Cubs gear. Like I, you know, a hat was $20. I got a fitted Cubs hat. And then I got a, you know, a jersey. And then I got this starter jacket. It's the same one. I've probably talked about it on here before because I still have it. It cost me 10 lawns at $10 a piece. And then, you know, whatever else, you know, I don't know, I might have had to pay for some tax. I don't even know what it was. But maybe we'll say 10 and a half lawns, right, to get this blue Cubs starter jacket. It had buttons. And when I go to the Wrigley Field press box, former Cubs broadcaster and President Ronald Reagan is throwing out the first pitch on the mound at Wrigley wearing that jacket. You know, so every time I'm in there, I think, I don't know how he got his. Someone might have just given it to him. I had to cut lawns for this jacket, but I remember going to school, and there were a few Cubs fans, you know. And then when, you know, you go to Wrigley, and you like you said, it's like everyone kind of just like congregates there, and there's just such a good feeling about it, you know, like, when you've been, I've been a Cubs fan. I mean, just forget about the broadcaster aspect of it. I've been a Cubs fan since, I don't know, the 80s, right? And I mean, like, and there's Cubs fans that I meet have been Cubs fans. There's a guy at the Cubs convention that says that he was a Cubs fan when they were in the World Series in 1945. And he remembers it. And he said he was at one of the games, you know? So, I mean, you're talking about way back. And I think that when, well, I know when the Cubs won the World Series, it was so special because, you know, you stick by this team that just hadn't won and all that stuff. And Cubs fans are special because of that. They really are great. You know, they're just so loyal. But I remember, like you said, going there and it's like, oh my gosh, like here's all these other people that kind of have that same experience. Like, you know, where were you when the Bartman game happened? Or, you know, what was the, you know, the feeling like in 84 when, you know, when the bad bounce happened against the Padres, or, you know, Cubs fans, and I'm friends with a lot of the Cubs that played in 1969, you know, and their disappointment that they weren't the team that got to the World Series and won it, you know, and how the Mets were just so hot at the end of that season and all that. But yeah, it is really cool when you are, and I'd say this too, I'm not a Yankees fan, but I've always had so much respect for the history of the Yankees, you know. And when you meet, like, real Yankees fans, it's always fun to talk to them about baseball, you know, and kind of that experience. I mean, except the difference is that there's so many Yankees fans, and they win so much, you know. I mean, they're not long-suffering, but you're amongst friends, though, you know, when you go to a game there.
You say they're not long-suffering. I guarantee you, if you find a Yankee fan, you can say, tell me about a moment where things were not so good. And they, let's say they're young, they can say, oh, when everybody went on the injured list this year. Or let's say they're older, they can say, oh, the Alvaro Espinosa years, or whatever it is. Everybody has some time when they just feel awful about their team. And, I'll tell you something else, too. I think that moments of fandom are tied so much into memory at other important parts of our lives. So, for example, let's say you're in college. You can remember, this is where I was in college when this World Series happened, or this huge moment happened. This is where I was as a kid when this huge moment happened. It's
right.
Those moments and that part of our life are tied inextricably together.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. Yeah, when Cal Ripken broke the streak, I mean, I can still remember where I was watching the game, you know, and thinking about all those years that he was the starting shortstop, you know, and then the third baseman, and then to play every single game for one team. I mean, being around it as a, you know, as a professional and watching the physical toll that it takes on your body to play, even at this level, you know, 140 games is amazing. And then for this guy, I know I'm digressing here, but I got to. I mean, you appreciate this. For this guy,
yes, I do.
Not only did he play every game when Lou Gehrig was, like, you know, putting his streak together, he would pinch hit and stuff. Cal Ripken started every game and played every, and he had played so many innings at one point they had to take him out of that streak because, you know, his dad was the manager and felt like it was the streak was starting to become, you know, like a heavy weight on his back. I don't know that we'll ever see anyone do that again. I just don't. I just don't think that the way that the human body's built, I mean, you have to be a super freak like Cal Ripken just to be able to play every day. Forget about putting up Hall of Fame stats and numbers.
I've got an interesting story for you that is tied into what happened with the Lansing Lugnuts yesterday against the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers, the Milwaukee Brewers affiliate. We played a suspended game. The game was suspended from Tuesday, and so they picked things back up on Wednesday, and they completed it. And according to baseball's rules, suspended games are considered completed the day that they start. So even though we finished it on May the 1st, we started it on April the 30th, therefore the game is considered to have ended on April the 30th. So I was looking up different fun facts about suspended games. Dan Musial put together in the 1950s the National League's consecutive game streak record. It was later broken. I think Billy Williams broke the record. But while Musial was putting it together, there was a game where, hey, it was humid, it was not great, he was tired, and he sat out. And it was the top of the ninth inning, and the game was suspended by rain. And they picked it up a month or so later, and when they picked it back up again quickly, the Cardinals put in Musial to pinch run, and it was considered as if that consecutive game streak has not ended at all. That continued his streak because the game was suspended and picked up at a time when he said, I'm good now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, that's what the rule's always been. I mean, like, you play in the game. Like, it's not you have to start the game. It doesn't mean you have to play five and a half innings. It means that you have to contribute. You know, what I love about this sport, and the Cubs, obviously a National League team, and even in Double A, we play National League baseball as long as the other affiliate that we're playing is a National League affiliate, right? So there's been we've had five games with the DH, and the rest of them have been with, you know, the pitchers batting, which is the way that I think baseball should be played. I didn't grow up knowing anything about National League baseball because the Orioles in Baltimore were an American League team. And then, you know, it wasn't until I became a Cubs fan in middle school that, like, you know, hey, look, all of a sudden I'm like watching pitchers bat. And what I really didn't appreciate even at that time that I do now is how important it is to have a good bench when you're a National League team, because everyone is relied on. You can't hide anyone with an NL roster. You know, why are the Cubs having a surge right now in the big leagues? Well, you look at that roster, and it's, you know, it's not just Chris Bryant and Javi Baez and Anthony Rizzo. I mean, they're great players. But it's also that when you go to the bench, there's not a big drop-off when you put in David Bodie or Ben Zobrist or whoever else it is, right? And those guys are going to contribute each and every night. It might just be a pinch hit spot, or it might be double switch to play some defense. But I love it. I love the fact that without the DH, that it really forces the players on your bench to stay in the game and be a part of the game. And so that's why when I look back at those, you know, hey, look, the guy pinch ran or the guy pinch hit, that pinch run or that pinch hit could be the difference, you know, between winning a game and not winning a game.
Let me add this too. The pride of being a pinch hitter or a pinch runner, there was just a feeling of certain guys that you could not wait to see them come off the bench in a key spot. You understood when it got late, seventh inning, eighth inning, ninth inning, that you had a guy that your manager, that your team could use, that you looked forward to him stepping up there to home plate.
Yeah, yeah. The Orioles had a guy named Alan Wiggins. He was really fast. And he, I mean, I don't know how good he was at baseball, but he was good at running. And even though they were an American League team, like, any time he would come in to pinch run, it was exciting just to watch the way that he could run the bases, you know. And Billy Hamilton's one of those guys. Eventually, you know, maybe he's coming off the bench. The Cubs had a guy last year, I forget his name. I want to say it might have been Goodwin, but or Gore. It was Gore. And Terrence Gore, I think. And he was just a fast guy. And they, you know, when you needed, like, a stolen base, you just throw him out there and you couldn't get him out, right? The problem is that he had a tough time getting on base, but if you needed him in a pinch running spot, you know, there he was, you know. So they're contributors too. And then think about the specialization of pitching now, you know, like having a closer, that guy that's going to come in and maybe throw 100 miles an hour, you know, they are not going to be able to keep that up, you know, for five or six innings, but they can do it for one, maybe, you know, two. And, you know, and if the game's different, maybe we don't see them.
The rules are going to change. We're going to see relievers for minimum three batters, especially at the start of innings, depending upon how the innings go. It's going to be fascinating to me to see the things that you and I grew up accustomed to that will no longer be a part of baseball come, let's say, 5 years down the road.
Yeah. And I talked to Joe Maddon about that during spring training, you know, just about the way that the rules were changing and you know, and some of the new rules. And, you know, he made it clear, you know, and publicly that he wasn't a big fan of that new rule where pitchers face three batters. But, you know, I know what baseball is trying to do. They want to, you know, maybe speed the game along and get rid of some of the specialization. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's just weird how we've changed the rules so much here lately, you know, and then the roster rules are changing, the September call-up thing's changing too. But, you know, I hope that they never do anything to damage the game because, look, I love the game the way that it is. I think it's a fun game. It's been a successful game longer than the NBA, longer than the NFL. Baseball's been around. I mean, the Reds are celebrating 150 years of Reds baseball. I mean, think about that. 150 years ago, here's guys that are just out of the Civil War, and they're playing for the Red Stockings, you know. So this game's been popular for a long time. I mean, you know the stories that they'd stop the Civil War and play baseball, you know, like both sides. I mean, like, it's crazy, right? So I hope that they don't do anything to, you know, I know they want to fit in and all that stuff and kind of speed the game up. But I hope they never change just how special this game is, you know. So I know they're tinkering with the rules right now. Last night, look, the Smokies played a game, and it went into the 10th inning. And you start with a ghost runner at second. I mean, it's a real guy, but, you know, he floated out there like a ghost without having to earn it. But you know what? I get it in the minor leagues because – you know, we don't have the personnel to play a 21-inning game or a 10-inning game, really. I mean, like, you're so strapped with the, you know, the players that you have and the rosters. They're not going to send up players because your minor league team win extra innings. But at the same time, I just would never want to see that become a major league thing unless, you know, it was something like maybe where they – I don't know, where they said, hey, look, after 12 innings, we're going to do it in the 13th, you know, something like that. And I'm still kind of on the fence with that. I like the game the way that it is, man. I'm a purist.
About the idea of the minor league experimental extra inning rule, I have a couple of thoughts. The first thought is it wasn't until I actually got into baseball and saw it from the other side that I started not liking extra innings. Because as a kid, extra innings meant as much baseball as possible, and I would root for games to go all night long. When it right. becomes a job, you don't want to stay at the ballpark forever, and especially when you understand how fragile pitching arms are, and that players only have so many pitches that they can throw before their arm just can't throw anymore. For whatever reason, the human body just can only give you so much. Not everybody is Nolan Ryan. So because of that, you have to limit pitching. You have to make sure that games end as soon as possible. That way, teams aren't exhausting their entire bullpens in one night. And the other thing is putting the runner at second base immediately adds excitement. Like, immediately.
Right.
Top half of the inning, whether the team scores them or not, if they don't score them, oh, they're in trouble in the bottom half. But even if the team in the top half scores, let's say, three runs, comes up in the bottom half down by three, if there's a single immediately, knocking in a run, the tying run is immediately at home plate. And so I've seen some really exciting extra inning games with that new rule. Although I agree with you, you can keep it in the minor leagues.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was kind of debating this, and then I read the comments that Jeff Samardzija made. You know, the Giants played so many extra inning games last year, and you use – a lot more pitching and you use a lot more players. And then the problem is that you don't have those guys for the next day or the next day. So you play one game that goes 16 innings or 17 innings or, you know, 20 innings, you know, I mean, who knows, you're going to be without those players and it's going to hurt you in the next game or the next series, you know, and it's a disadvantage.
Yes.
And he had mentioned that. And I thought, you know, I used to, well, I don't want to tie, but then when I look at it like you're saying now, it really can mess you up for a long time. You know, it takes a week to get over that. And then going back to Joe Maddon, the Cubs manager, you know, it was another thing that we kind of touched on. And he said, you know, if they allowed you to expand your roster, say if you played an extra inning game and then they let you go get someone from the minor league to give you an extra pitcher for, like, say, a couple of days afterwards, you know, that would make a lot of sense. And I agree. I mean, there has to be some kind of, you know, trade-off, because if you play three straight extra inning games, I mean, that's really going to tax the availability of the pitching that you have, you know. And you're right, arms are fragile, and you don't want to see guys get hurt. And then the other thing is that, you know, extra innings is a competitive disadvantage.
We laugh at position players pitching. Ha, 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 position player on the mound. The message that a position player pitching sends to me is, Adam Warren, hey, you're not a prospect. Because if you were a prospect, we wouldn't want to chance you suffering an injury. So it's right. Really a blow to a guy's ego. I know hitters who hate to bat against position players pitching because they're not sure what they should do. They're worried about overswinging. They can't get out, or else there's a blow to their ego. So there's the element of fun to it, but there's also the feeling of we're getting away from the side of baseball that is competitive and enthralling.
When I was in Chattanooga, there was a guy who played center field. His name was Rick Assadorian, great, great athlete. First-round pick by the Red
Sox.
Yeah,
outfielder, first-rounder of the Red Sox, right?
Right. And so we were in Jackson, Tennessee, extra innings. He always had a great arm, maybe the strongest arm on the team, kind of a Sean Dunstan type for Cubs fans. You remember Harry would always talk about it when Dunstan would throw those bullets across the infield from short to first, you know. Maybe the best arm on the field, and it's Dunstan. And so Assadorian came in the game and pitched two innings of relief and got the win. And at this point, I mean, he just wasn't a prospect anymore. But, you know, he still had tools. And it was really exciting. And then a couple of years later, you know, he went back through and tried to work himself up to the big leagues as a pitcher. You know, so he never got to the major leagues that I know of, but it still gave him an opportunity to extend his career. And I guess that, you know, Smokies fans would tell you here at this stadium, they had a guy named Rick Ankiel, who was a pitcher and then came back as a hitter and made it to the big leagues in both spots, you know, which is really amazing, right? So a lot of these guys, you grow up, you play, you do both things, and you know, like they're good at both things. And some of these guys are great at it. And, you know, once in a while, I mean, once in a blue moon, you'll have a guy that, you know, that it didn't work out in one aspect. And because of an opportunity in one of those extra inning games, like showed something, you know, and oh, wait, maybe this guy can do it. And the next thing you know, there it is.
Feels like it's bringing us back around to the initial point of the guys who could play multiple sports. The guys who you can't just pen them in and say they're going to do one thing. No, they can do multiple things, whether it's baseball/football or whether it's hit/pitch.
Yep. And I mean, like, and I think that, you know, going back to my initial thought about Gary Hughes and going after great athletes as a scout, whether it be, you know, baseball, football, basketball, or whatever, maybe even track and field. You know, the Cubs, you look for guys who maybe they come here, they get it figured out, and they become great baseball players just by being able to go out there and do the physical part of it, and then maybe they pick up the mental part of it, you know. But it's a great game, and, you know, all in all, I worry a little bit about the slotted draft because I hate the idea of baseball losing out on players like Kyler Murray, you know, and whoever. I mean, not to say that didn't want to play football first, that's his first love, but anytime that those great athletes go to another sport, it hurts the game.
Yeah, that's the big thing. What makes baseball good? The players make it good. The high-quality talents make it good. If Vladimir Guerrero Jr. comes up to the major leagues, the reason why we're also excited about him is because he's considered a special hitter. And there are other special talents working their way through the minor leagues. I agree with you. We want more of them, not less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the better the players, the better the game, you know. And I feel like in some aspects, I feel like overall the players are better now. But I think that that has to do with the technology and the experience. You know, these guys play so much more baseball. You know, like Christian Donahue, who's the second baseman for the Smokies, was on the Little League World Series championship team from Hawaii, right? I mean, like, you play around just awesome players, right? I mean, you know, and then Nico Horner, who's the shortstop and the Cubs' number one prospect, played on travel teams with like 8 first rounders. I mean, you know, and you're going all over the country. I mean, I was talking to him at the batting cage in Florida, and I said, hey, have you ever been here before? Yeah, we you know, to come from California here to play travel ball tournaments, you know. Guys, you know, in the past, they didn't do that. You know, you played for your high school, you played for the American Legion, you know, and now it's like it's so much specialized, and there's a lot of players who have played a ton of games and really get the baseball part of it. But, you know, I feel like baseball is losing out to soccer. I think they're losing out to basketball. I think they're losing out to football. And in popularity and for us, you know, the advocates of the game, you know, it's just continue to try to push to make it, you know, the pastime that we know and we love, you know. And so the better that the athletes are, the better the game's going to be, and the better the game is, then more people are going to watch, you know. But, I mean, baseball's got some issues right now. Mike Trout, one of the greatest of all time. And there's people that, I mean, oddly, that have never seen him play and don't know who he is. And I think he's better than Mickey Mantle. I think he's like a Joe DiMaggio type of guy, you know. Like, he's just that incredible of a talent, you know. And he's playing right now, and you can go watch him right now. But there's people that don't know him.
Tell you what, takes better care of his body than Mantle did.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a beast. He looks like he could play linebacker in football.
Right. Nick, on that note, this has been our Ballpark Digest broadcaster chat. Thank you very much for joining me.
Hey, a lot of fun. And it's weird not looking at you on the split screen, but I'll tell you what, it was fun talking, and we're on the radio anyway, so it's a normal day for us. And look forward to doing it again next week.
Exactly. Check out Ballpark Digest, ballparkdigest.com, at Ballpark Digest on Twitter. Kevin Reichardt is the publisher and owner. From Mick Gillespie of the Tennessee Smokies, I'm Jesse Goldberg-Strasser with the Lansing Lugnuts, and take care until next week.